his entire adult life as anyone knew. He OD'd on heroin and died. So those, as far as the family trauma, those were the two big events. And I mean, my book is about Big Love. It's a collection of personal essays, and it's about moments in my life that I feel have kind of rocked me from my center, and the ways in which I found my way back, you know, and the tools I used. And those were two profound moments, especially my parents. And I don't think in the beginning I actually had any tools to use to find my way back to center when I was 14. And I feel thankful that at the time, subconsciously, I made the choice to just bury it completely. And only once a year would I even cry about my parents, in this like a meltdown cry once a year, then bottle it up and move on with my life and carry on as a good student and a popular kid. And I went to college, and a good college, and was a good student and a popular kid. And into my 20s, once I left college and moved to San Francisco, that's the first time I really started to open up to the possibility of looking at the grief around my parents differently, and actually making space for all of the tears and all of the rage and all of the sadness that I had been locking away for so long. And that really set me on a more spiritual journey. You know, it's when I first became introduced to books that were talking about love and peace and enlightenment and pain. And I started to recognize that the many years of bottling up my true emotions had also put walls up to deeper connections with people in my life, because I had created such a big secret around my parents' death. So that's when everything started to open and change and set me on the path that I've been on, you know, for the past 20 years, and has culminated, at least for now, in this book that is written with the hope that people will consider choosing love and all that love invites in their lives more often, and see how that transforms their lives and our world more positively. That was a long answer.
No, well, we've got an hour to fill, so okay. Take all the time you need. You actually mention there's a story of you were on an airplane and there was a woman in the aisle next to you who had just lost her father. And after reading that story, I wanted to actually share that my upbringing wasn't quite as dramatic, but I do feel like I have been there. Both of my parents passed away when I was very young, and also my closest friend growing up in high school died from drug addiction. So I feel for you there. I can feel it. And one of the things I noticed, I mean, you mentioned that you kind of locked those feelings away because how else are you going to function, really? Yeah. But when those feelings did come up, when you were talking about your brother's addiction, there was a lot of judgment there for a lot of time. And I think that's a normal stage that we all go through when we see people hurting themselves. Do you want to talk about how you got past that, or what changed for you?
Sure. I mean, with my brother Ricky, you know, he became addicted to heroin when he was around 18, and he is 18 years my senior. So my entire life of knowing him was through the lens of addiction. And that was in part, you know, that colored my relationship with him from the very beginning. So when I was a kid, especially, I was really angry at him and judged him terribly at the time, because I couldn't make sense in my mind of the choices he was making and all of the heartache he was causing my parents and family. You know, I was a young kid, but I was, you know, when you're the youngest of a bunch of siblings, you do what you can to eavesdrop and figure out the family drama on your own. And I was definitely pretty good at that. And I was highly aware of, you know, of the trauma he was bringing home when he was around. So I loved him, and I recognized him as a big-hearted, good person. Most of my energy with him was spent resenting him, and, as you said, judging him for the choices he was making. As I got older, I came to to recognize my brother, and this was even more so after he died, as, you know, a highly sensitive human being who couldn't figure out how to be present in this world without numbing and escaping into heroin. And when I look around at the world we're living in, I see it as an incredibly addictive place. And I think that if you're not an active addict addicted to something, most of us are riding the line or moderately addicted to something, even if it's just social media. And so I really don't judge addiction the way I used to. I see it as an extreme version of numbing and escaping, feeling the uncomfortable feelings that we are all trying to avoid feeling, and feeling the often dark and crazy reality of this world we live in. You know, we're all doing our best to make sense of it, and we're all doing our best to deal with our own struggles, and we're all struggling, but we're also all hiding because it's become somehow not okay to be uncomfortable, you know, with our feelings, and we always have to be happy all the time or something's wrong. And, you know, that just helped me find more really empathy with my brother, trying to, without knowing exactly what it was for him that he was escaping from, recognizing him as another human being who's struggling and doing his best. And it was through empathy and compassion that I felt like I was able to forgive him for how I believed he wronged our family.
Thank you.
Come to the Allard Prize for International Integrity Award ceremony, Thursday, September 28th, featuring Glenn Greenwald, who broke the story of U.S. whistleblower Edward Snowden and co-founded The Intercept. It will celebrate an Egyptian human rights lawyer, an Azerbaijani journalist, and a Brazilian prosecution task force. Visit tinyurl.com/Allard2017 to reserve tickets.
The Crane Library is looking for student volunteers to record textbooks for those who cannot use print at the university. If you are a UBC student who is computer literate with an ability to read university material aloud and you have a willingness to learn new techniques, we ask for a 2-hour commitment once a week. For additional information and to set up an audition, call 604-822-6114 or email crane.volunteer@ubc.ca.
We are speaking right now with Scott Stabile. You can find him at scottstabile.com. The last name is spelled S-T-A-B-I-L-E. He's the author of Big Love, The Power of Living with a Wide Open Heart. If you're listening from Vancouver, he's going to be at Banyan Books on Thursday, October 5th at 6:30 p.m. doing a book signing and all of that. And there's also a workshop coming up on Saturday. If you go to the Banyan event, I'm sure you'll hear all about it. And the Banyan Books event is free for all. So check that out if you're interested. And now I totally forgot my train of thought here. Oh, you were talking about how become wrong to have any negative feelings. And I kind of want to call myself out on that. I feel like this show has contributed to that mentality. There was a period of time, you know, after the movie The Secret came out, where I really was in denial of my feelings and kind of struggling with, well, if I want to be a good person or a successful person, that means that I have to be happy all the time. And one of the consequences of that, I mean, it's kind of a balance, because if you wallow in your crap, well, that's not really healthy.
Right.
But if you deny it, well, we all know what happens when that happens. So where's the balance?
Well, one, I'm with you, Marie. I have posted, you know, I've had my Facebook page going for about 5 years now or just over. And I know in the past I've posted several things that have basically said what I see all the time, which is happiness is a choice, or suggested that we can choose our happiness. And the thing I feel about it is I don't feel it's any more real to be a Pollyanna who's always smiling and everything's perfect than it is to be someone who's always miserable and nothing's ever good. I think that there is a balance in life, and it's about honoring that balance. And when I say to people, happiness is not a choice, even though there are thousands of memes that declare it is and that we can just choose happiness. You know, I've never been able to just say I choose happiness when I've been miserable and then suddenly turn to happiness. You know, I think that we need to be honest and realistic about that and recognize that happiness is an emotion and we don't choose our emotions. You know, we feel how we feel no matter what we're thinking. But the balance for me is in recognizing that I can absolutely make conscious choices that stand to affect my emotions in a more positive way. So though I can't choose happiness, I can choose to do things that tend to make me happy. The example I use in the book is playing tennis and knowing that when I play tennis, there's a decent chance it's going to bring joy to my life because I really enjoy playing tennis. But choosing to play tennis is very different than choosing to be happy. So I encourage people to figure out the things in their life that tends to bring them joy. That could be a nice walk in a park. It could be meditation. It could be dancing your butt off in your apartment. Whatever it is, figure out what brings you joy and then make more time for those things in your life. And the likelihood is you're going to find yourself experiencing joy more often. That's been my experience with it.
Absolutely. So it's almost like a cognitive behavioral type view where I know I deal with depression as well. And it used to be when I got really depressed, I would just stay in bed and I'd eat ice cream and chips and I'd put on 50 pounds and lose my job. And it was horrible. And now I went through that period where denying the depression and just like, okay, everything's great. Right. Was sort of how I tried to function. And it was always this goal of getting better, of never experiencing depression again. And what helped me was when I started to notice depression and I felt the urge to stay in bed, I would force myself to get up and force myself to go outside or talk to someone or all of those behavioral things that contribute to a better mood. And it wouldn't make the depression go away. But when the depression finally lifted, my life was still there. It hadn't fallen apart.
Absolutely. I love that example. It's a beautiful example. And I just think that we're really well served by recognizing that we're all human beings. We're all struggling. We all know all the emotions. And if we weren't designed to feel all the emotions, they wouldn't exist. And it's okay to not be happy. In fact, I've gotten some really beautiful gifts from the sadness I felt in my life, one of which is being able to connect to others going through their pain in a much more empathetic and compassionate way than I would have otherwise had I not gone through my own grief and pain in life. You know, so I just, I don't think we're well served by pressuring ourselves to be happy all the time.
And judging ourselves when we're not. And,
right, because then on top of not being happy, we feel like failures. You know, we feel like we're total spiritual screw-ups because, wait a minute, we're supposed to be able to choose happiness, but I'm not doing it, so I'm unhappy, I'm a failure, and then we just feel worse about ourselves.
I hear you. Been there. Do it all. I still do it.
I still do it too, even though I'm saying all this.
Yeah. I mean, the goal is to not do it and then to forgive myself when I do it, but I still do it. So you were, I don't know exactly the best way to jump into this, but you were in a cult for 13 years. Yes. Tell us about that.
Woo-hoo. No, I'm kidding. Well, yeah, I mean, I was in a cult, a spiritual community. I see it as a cult. And I got involved in my mid-20s. I was living in San Francisco at the time and had befriended several people who were working at a store where I was working. And they were these amazingly beautiful people who were talking about love and peace and enlightenment all the time. And these were topics I wasn't used to discussing, and I had never even heard of enlightenment, I don't think, at that point in my life. But I loved it. I loved the idea that you could have love as a goal rather than what career you're doing or how much money you're making. And I really connected with these people, and they were all students of this area guru whom I eventually met. And he professed himself to be an enlightened master, you know, on par with Jesus or Buddha or any other enlightened masters out there. And he spoke about unconditional love and freedom and unconditional friendship. And I was hooked. You know, I was in a community of people between probably 20 to 30 people at any given time. You know, students and the guru and all this talk of love and surrender and being real with who you are and your pain and all of this stuff. And it was in many ways very beautiful. And I still look on much of my experience there with fondness, because I feel like that it was in my time there that I really rooted myself in my belief that love is the way in this lifetime. But what I came to feel and struggled against through most of my years there was I didn't believe what he was saying about his own enlightenment and his own unconditional nature of love. I found him to say and do things that felt incredibly egomaniacal and manipulative and full of just lies, frankly. So I would justify it in my head. I mean, there's so much manipulation that goes on in this kind of environment, and this was like my family and my community. So you're surrounded by people who are all speaking about him as an enlightened master. It was in no way okay to talk negatively about him. He reflected on anything that was in any way provocative. It was always that he was a puppet of God, and everything that he's saying and doing is a reflection of God's will for us. So you work hard to convince yourself that's the case. And in doing so, you're judging yourself constantly whenever you're criticizing him in your head for anything. And I would always justify it by saying, well, I'm not enlightened, so I don't really know what enlightenment looks like, even in the moments when enlightenment just looked and sounded very kind of cruel and manipulative and crazy. So I was in it for 13 years. I wasn't always living in the Bay Area while I was a part of the cult. I was, you know, I spent several years living in other cities, but several years also there, in the last few years, you know, really immersed in the cult, but realizing that his path, which is ostensibly one of unconditional love, was just predicated on a grand lie that he is an enlightened master when he's just not. And I finally accepted that. And finally, after about a year of deliberation, you know, found the courage to tell him I no longer want him as my teacher, though I did want to connect friends with my, you know, the community, because they were the closest people in my life. And ultimately that wasn't okay, which was one of the reasons I hesitated to leave so much, because I knew I could potentially be giving up my family of friends. And he instructed them all to delete me from their lives, and they did, you know, without explanation. Only my closest friend took the time to send me a text that said, please don't ever contact me again. And it's been about 8 years since that day.
Wow.
So, and that was incredibly traumatic. I mean, I'm talking about it very nonchalantly now, but losing, I lost my family of friends overnight, you know, the people, really most of the people closest to me in my life. You know, after losing my parents, really the most traumatic thing I've gone through.
I can imagine. I can only imagine. It almost seems like the cult, I feel like there's cults where you all live in the same house and then you drink Kool-Aid and jump on a spaceship. But there's also sort of a cult like community or a culty vibe that people can get, just whether it's in an online community or, and I feel like that inability to, that restriction of pointing out any discrepancies and kind of wanting to talk about them, and in addition to the shunning of like, oh, well, you're a negative person if you say anything, or if you leave this group, we don't want to know you. I feel like those are two of the biggest things that make a cult a cult.
Exactly. And you know, when I write about it in the book, it was really important to me not to write about this experience from a vindictive place, because that isn't at all my intention with what I'm doing in my life and with this book. You know, the point was to be clear about my experience and to call out certain elements of the experience, but also just to remind people that no matter what quote unquote tribe you're a part of, if even if all of your friends are in love with a specific teacher or a specific way of doing things, a specific religion, and it is not feeling okay to you in your heart, it is okay to move on. And that when we do, even if a teacher has served you in many positive ways for 5 or 10 years, and you're finding that the experience no longer serves you in a way that is benefiting you positively, it's okay to move on. And when we move on from the experiences and teachers that are no longer serving us, we create space and invitations for more. Because I suspect you, Marie, and I'm sure your listeners, and I know myself, like, we're all seekers. And seekers, spiritual seekers, tend to seek out teachers. And I'm always looking for teachers in the books I'm reading and in the podcasts and radio shows I'm listening to and in the people I engage with. And that's beautiful and important. And but it is critically important to recognize that you are the one critical component to your growth in this lifetime. I am the one critical component to my growth in this lifetime. And that we can invite whomever we want to participate in that, and we can disinvite whomever we want to. And that was really the point of the chapter. And what's amazing is, you know, my cult wasn't sexy. When I say sexy, I don't really mean sexy, but like, it's not the cult that's going to make the news, because there's no Kool-Aid and no spaceships and no murders. And it's, you know, it's nothing like that. But I've already received notes from a few different people about that chapter specifically, letting me know that they were involved in a very similar sounding community that did a lot of damage on their psyche. And I know friends who left my cult who spent years in therapy dealing with PTSD because of their experiences there. Because when you get in an environment like that, and when you're told how to be, it's not that different from some people's experience with the confines of certain religions. You know, when you're being told that if you're not operating within these conditions, there's something wrong with you, and you spend years convincing yourself there's something wrong with you, it's very difficult to get out of it and to move on. And even now, if I'm honest, it's like 97% of my mind believes everything I'm saying, but there's still this 3% that's like, well, what if he is an enlightened guru and I'm totally misjudged? Even, you know what I'm saying? There's still that brainwashed portion that doesn't want to let go of all of those years of believing it.
Absolutely. When I was reading that statement about the 97% and the 3%, it reminded me of abusive relationships. You know, I remember a relationship I had when I was very young, and he was much too old for me. And he would say things like, you know, no one is ever going to love you the way that I love you. You'll never find someone again like me. And there's always, and I could see that the guy was not appropriate, I'll say in the nicest way possible. I'm trying not to be judgmental, but there's always that question in the back of my mind, well, is he right? And every breakup I've gone through has been like, well, maybe that is the last person I'll be with, or maybe all of the bad things that someone said about me, maybe those things are true. Mm-hmm. And I think that's true of any type of abusive relationship. I mean, even, and it doesn't have to be religious or spiritual. I mean, just look at the political climate we're in right now. If you disagree with the right, you're bad. If you're on the left wing and you disagree with anything they say, you're bad.
Yeah.
It's like there's nobody is willing to have a discussion about what's actually what might work.
Hear. And again, I would just say the word empathy. You know, I think that what is missing on a profound level in the world, and I'm, you know, I live in the U.S., so I'm seeing it in as profound a level as I've ever seen it in my lifetime, is the lack of empathy that so many of us are bringing to our dialogues. And I feel that if we only, you know, I'm clear with my political convictions. I'm not going to pretend that I don't have political convictions. But what I'm really trying to do, and I'm also really angry a lot about all the injustices I see, because it's insane the level of injustice that exists in the world. Yeah. But what I'm trying to do is not just stop with the anger in terms of how I show up for communications and dialogues about it, because I think anger serves as a great catalyst to get you off your butt. And your anger tells you what you're passionate about and what you want to speak up for or speak up against. But anger doesn't get us to the place of healing in anything. You know, so what I'm trying to do, and I'm certainly not always successful, is when I'm choosing to talk about politics and be engaged in that arena, how I'm asking myself constantly, it's like, what can my love do with all this anger? You know, how can I weave compassion into the anger I feel, so that when I'm showing up and someone's posting this thing that I find so outrageous and offensive and whatever online, if I'm going to choose to respond, only respond if you can bring empathy and compassion to the table. Only respond if you can take 30 seconds to recognize that the person on the other end of this discussion is also a human being. And can you imagine at all what it might be like to walk in that person's shoes? Because when we do that, when we bring that level of empathy to our dialogues, it's really hard to show up with hatred in your heart. You know, I've never been able to really, really consider the person in front of me and their experience and their struggle and still go at them with hatred in my heart. It just doesn't happen. But it takes work. You know, people talk about love like it's this ooey gooey, wishy washy, weak, soft thing. And when people bring that up to me, well, isn't love this ooey gooey, wishy washy, you know, in their own words. And I say to them, well, let me ask you, if someone's raging at you in your face and calling you names, how easy is it going to be for you to go to love with them? You know, love is almost always the harder choice, especially in this day and age and with the ease of being, you know, insane and rage-filled on social media. Love is almost always the harder choice to make. We naturally go to blame and go to rage and go to judgment and condemnation. Those things happen with no thought and no effort. So what I'm trying to do, and I'm doing it with myself all the time, and that's one of the points of Big Love, is just to encourage people to, you know, ask yourself the question, what does love invite in this moment? How is love asking me to respond? And see, just sit with that question and see. And in my experience, when I take time with that question and when I act in accordance with the energy of love, I only have something positive to offer myself, the other person, and the world at large.
Beautifully said.
Thank you.
High school is not free in Kenya, East Africa. As well as tuition fees, families must find money for uniforms, including shoes, textbooks, calculators, dictionaries, pens, pencils, and more. For poor rural families earning the equivalent of $2 to $3 a day, this is often an impossible challenge. Will you help educate bright, very poor Kenyan youth to help them find a road out of poverty for their families? Just $50 a month will allow that to happen. Gifts of smaller amounts can be combined to give youth a chance through KEEF, the Kenya Education Endowment Fund, a registered, BC-based, volunteer-run educational charity. Tax-deductible receipts are available. Donations make great gifts for Christmas, graduation, anniversaries, promotions, etc. Gift cards are available. More information at www.kenyaeducation.org, or you can call us at 604-415-9397, day or evening.
We are speaking with Scott Stabile. He is the author of Big Love, The Power of Living with a Wide Open Heart. If you're listening from Vancouver, he's going to be at Banyan Books on Thursday, October 5th at 6:30 p.m. That is a free event. He'll also be doing an all-day workshop in North Vancouver on Saturday. You can find more about that on his website, scottstabile.com. His last name is spelled S-T-A-B-I-L-E. .com. And you talk about living with a wide open heart, and you mentioned the ooey gooey love, and I kind of see the wide open heart. I mean, my heart half the time is just this gaping. It's gaping.
I shouldn't laugh at that.
So no, it is, it's funny, right? I'm in an ironic, sad way. But like, so where do boundaries come in? Because you can't just be like, oh yeah, punch me, do whatever you want. So where's the boundaries along with the love?
Well, I actually think boundaries are a part of living with a wide open heart, because boundaries for me reflect self-care. And I'm a big fan of self-care, and I write about self-care and talk about self-care a lot. And, you know, I think that we spiritual wannabe loving types, we tend to sometimes view boundaries as us being difficult. So if I'm setting boundaries, I'm being difficult and people are going to judge me as difficult, and I'm not being as open as I can be if I'm setting boundaries. But I don't see boundaries at all like that. I think that by setting boundaries and being clear about what does work for us and what does not work for us, we're showing respect for everyone involved. Because in my experience, and there are exceptions to this, but in my experience, we human beings don't want to trample over each other's boundaries, but so often we don't know what they are. You know, I could be stepping over your boundaries, Marie, simply because you never told me what they were, because you feel guilty about setting boundaries, because that makes you seem like a less loving person. I'm projecting now, because that's the reason I've refrained from setting boundaries in my life. But I love to know what people's boundaries are. I don't take joy in stepping on people's boundaries. So I love it when people are really clear with what works for them. And I just think it's respectful. You know, what I see, I think if we are walking through, I think boundaries and walls are very different. The times in my life when I've put walls up, I don't think that served me in any way, because when I put walls up, I'm blocking out any possibility for connection. But when I put boundaries up, I feel like I'm inviting connection, but with certain conditions. And I think that's healthy and great and totally aligned with heartful living.
Thank you, Scott. Well, I don't want to harp on the cult thing, but yeah, I'm kind of harping on the cult thing. I'm wondering where, because I imagine that when we do get sucked into that type of world, it's part of it is because of lack of boundaries. What's your opinion on that?
Well, in the cult there are no boundaries. Let me think if that's an honest statement. I mean, yeah, you're exposed. I mean, that was part of the agreement you're making in being on that path with that guru, is that he can say anything to you at any point in front of anybody, because the idea was that he was picking at your pockets of darkness and pain and exposing them so you'd have to face them. And I, in general, I do like that kind of growth and healing. Like, I like digging into my darkness. You know, I kept it hidden for so long, and it was such a secret, and I was so unwilling to face the uglier parts of myself for so long that I actually welcome that introspection, even though it's not a joy to see how envious and jealous and ugly I can be. But at least it's real, and at least when I acknowledge it, I don't have to let it control me. You know what I mean? I can acknowledge it as, you know, thoughts from my ego and not what's really guiding me through this life. But in the cult, it's you're like signing on an invisible dotted line that you have no boundaries. We had lots of student meetings, and people are called out on their stuff and exposed in extremely boundaryless ways. But I signed up for it in the moment. Like, that was the least of my issues with the cult, honestly. But for others, I know that was a very big issue, you know, that sense of exposure.
Well, there's a difference. I mean, I really value being called on my crap, especially if it's done in a respectful way, because we're not, you know, I mean, if we're in denial about something or just not aware of it, how are we ever going to grow out of it if someone doesn't point it out, right? So thank you for telling me I'm being a hypocritical what not you know, maybe say it nicer than that, but you know, I appreciate that. I want to be called out on it, but there's a difference between if you're able to say, hey, that wasn't cool that you said it in front of everybody, or hey, I've got a problem with this, can we discuss it, you know, that hurt my feelings when you said that, and then the person apologizing for the way they said it or whatever. I mean, that's different than just being like, well, I'm going to say whatever I want and you're just going to take it, and if not, then you lose all your friends.
Right. No, it's true. And I mean, I think what you just said is something really important in terms of how we approach our friendships in general, I think that, at least in the experience I've had, it can be really difficult to call out our friends on their BS, and it can be really difficult to receive that criticism from friends. But I found, like, the deepest friendships I have are the ones where we feel the freedom to be honest with one another and to hold up a mirror when the other is acting like a jerk or disrespectful or whatever. And I think that we're really well served with people we trust, you know, with the people we trust, we're really well served to make ourselves available for those types of communications. Because for me, the best friends aren't necessarily just the ones you're having fun with and a good time with, and the ones who are, you're constantly telling, you know, I love you, and I love you too, and you're beautiful. That's important, absolutely, and I adore that, those parts of my friendships. But, you know, can you stay present in your kindness and compassion when a friend is looking you in the eyes and saying, what you're doing right now is incredibly hurtful to me, and these are the reasons why? But that's how we really deepen and strengthen our connections with each other, when we can also present and listen to the hard stuff with more compassion, more empathy.
Absolutely. And we don't always get it right, though. I mean, we're human, so.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I often don't get it right.
Again, we're speaking with Scott Stabile. He's the author of Big Love, The Power of Living with a Wide Open Heart, and not a gaping heart, a wide open heart
with boundaries.
So we just have a little bit of time left in the show, so I'm wondering where you want to take this conversation. What do you want to talk about?
What do I want to talk about? Ooh, good question. No one ever asks me that. I'm like, wait a minute, I'm thrown. No, you know, one thing I would like to say about the book too, one of my hopes for it is just, I really want people to know that they're not alone in their struggle, and to recognize that though we don't have the exact same circumstances in our lives necessarily, we all understand what it's like to feel sadness and to feel joy and to feel envious and to feel pain. We all know these things. And what I've learned from my Facebook community over and over and over again, and what has been a great gift, is the recognition that when I'm going through something, I'm not the only one I'm probably not the only one who's going through it in that exact moment, and I'm definitely not the only one to have gone through it. And when I've shared on my Facebook page some of my deeper insecurities and my deeper fears or experiences and, you know, circumstances in my life that were really painful, those are the posts that always get the biggest response. And it's so often with people commenting, you know, you are not alone, and me too, and thank you for sharing this. It's so good to know I'm not alone. And so I really just like to remind people they're not alone, because I know when we're going through the darker stuff, it's so easy to feel so alone and like there is no light beyond this darkness that we're feeling. But when we can, as you said earlier, when in dealing with depression, when we can really push ourselves to connect in some way, whether it's in social media, whether it's in real life, whether it's through a phone call, if we can make the effort to connect with our fellow human beings, reach out, make ourselves available to that kind of connection, we really, really, really serve ourselves. And in knowing and understanding that we're not alone in our struggle, that has helped me so much to, in those moments when I feel like I can't see the other side of it. So that's one thing, you know, and with the book, I tried to just share really honestly about many experiences in my life, in hopes that even if people couldn't connect to exactly what I'm talking about, there would be a lot of aha moments for them. Like, yeah, I get it. I experienced that too. Yeah, I think those thoughts too. Yeah, you were a jerk in that situation. I'm a jerk like that too. And we're all human, and it's okay, you know?
Yeah. Oh, well, I love that you share the times when you were a jerk also, because so many times, and I think it's just because of that image of that belief, that false belief that we have to just be shiny and happy all the time. A lot of speakers, teachers, authors only want to share, or even just our friends on Facebook, they only want to share the bright and shiny sides of themselves.
Yeah.
And it kind of ends up being false. And I'm not articulating it well.
Well, I think you are. I mean, I just know my response to that is to, I respond to the artists, thinkers, writers, teachers out there who are willing to verbalize, vocalize their humanity and all like the idiosyncrasies that make them who they are, the, you know, quote unquote flaws that make them who they are, the imperfections that make them who they are. When people are willing to be honest about that stuff, as well as like the deep wisdom they have from their experiences, I'm all in. You know, I think that there are some teachers out there who, for me, like Eckhart Tolle, for instance, The Power of Now, is one of my favorite books ever written. And he's bringing forth such clarity and wisdom. And he's not out there talking about everything that's wrong with him, you know, necessarily, but he's making a point about the present moment and being in the now and all that invites into our lives in such a clear and precise way that I read that book and I'm filled with delight. But I, you know, there are a lot of teachers, I think, who profess to have it all together and to be quote unquote enlightened and without their humanity. And I don't tend to buy it because I've met a lot of really wise people and no one's got it all together. You know, we're all still struggling in moments.
Absolutely. That is, oh my gosh. I feel exactly the same way. Like there is this ideal that we live up to, this love, this compassion, this living in the present moment. And sometimes we really rock at it.
Right.
And we're doing great. But, and there are definitely people who rock at it a bigger percentage of the time than others. But honestly, I do not believe that there is a single truly enlightened person on this planet who never has an angry or hateful moment. It is all part of the experience of being a human. And we can train ourselves to not get sucked into that drama or ego or pain body, whatever you want to call it. But I feel like when people put themselves up on this, portray themselves as like never having a bad day, it's actually doing a disservice, because for the longest time I would look at people like that and think, how is it possible that I could ever be that way? Well, guess what? It's probably not.
Right, exactly.
And that's okay.
Exactly. Yeah, we get caught in the trap of judging ourselves against these perceived perfect people who aren't really perfect, but are presenting that. And yeah, I love, though, I think there's a different movement happening in a big way where people are being very wise people, very creative people, you know, very loving people are much more okay with sharing the whole story, you know, and we're seeing it out there, you know, just people telling their truth and putting it all out there for others to help others feel more okay in their truth and not like they have to meet some false standard. It's like standards of beauty that are so false and ridiculous. It's, you know what I'm saying? It's all the same thing. And I'm much more excited by the teachers out there who are like, I'm a human, I'm super messy, you have no idea, here it is. And I'm also really loving and really committed to being loving as often as I can be. And that makes a big, big difference in my life.
Mm. Yeah. Oh, I love that. I'm so glad that we're having this conversation, Scott.
Cool. Me too. Thank you.
And now a message from a very excited radio announcer.
Oh, sorry. I mean, Just for Laughs.
Just for Laughs presents the Alternative Comedy Tour.
We gotta get out of here!
Featuring star of Silicon Valley, Deadpool, and everything else you like, TJ Miller.
Yeah, I was the star of Yogi Bear 3D, but I don't need to get into that.
With special guest, Flight of the Conchords, Reese Darby.
I probably shouldn't be doing this. It's a risk.
And hosted by Nick Vatterott. The Just for Laughs Alternative Comedy Tour at the Vogue Theater, November 17th. On sale now at Ticketfly.com. For details, check Metro News or go to hahaha.com/alternative.
This has been a message from Just for Laughs Alternative Comedy Tour.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is Monday.
One, two, three.
to 3 p.m.
Who is this guy? Does he have a name? Does anybody know where he's from?
From parts unknown.
My name's Chris Horrific.
You always wanted his character to be bigger than life.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is without question the greatest sports and entertainment event of all time. Be a part of it Monday
from 1 to 3 p.m.
The Parts Unknown Show on 101.9 CITR. Sometimes cosmoses collide.
The Parts Unknown.
Break your fingers.
Up next is Parts Unknown with DJ Chris Horrific on CITR.
We are talking right now with Scott Stabile. He is the author of Big Love, The Power of Living with a Wide Open Heart. If you're listening from Vancouver, he's going to be at Banyan Books on Thursday, October 5th at 6:30 p.m. That's a free book signing, book reading. And he'll be in North Vancouver all day on the Saturday, which is like, what, the 7th?
The 7th, yeah.
And his email... website address. All my imperfections are coming out. ScottStabile.com. His last name is spelled STABILE.com. I'm been reading a lot about stoicism lately. And it's not quite so lovey-dovey as the whole love thing, but it is, there is compassion, having compassion for people who are not doing what we might judge as good a job as we'd like them to. But there's also that understanding that this is an ideal that we're going through, and nobody, none of the Marcus Aurelius or anyone who was a Stoic or anyone who was, you know, living 99% of the time in a loving state, it doesn't mean that they don't still have their 1% bad days.
Absolutely. And I mean, one of the things we can control within the realm of our, you know, the nasty thoughts and stuff like that is because we're all, as much as we have more control over some of our thoughts and no control over our feelings, we still don't control a lot of our thoughts. I mean, our thoughts are happening at lightning speed, and we're judging people before we even realize we're judging them so often. But we can control our actions. You know, even when I'm thinking unnecessarily judgmental and blameful thoughts, I don't have to act in accordance with those thoughts. We can always choose to be kind. You know, we can always show up to dialogues, to interactions, to wherever, with the intention and commitment to acting in kindness. And I feel like it's how we show up in our actions that more accurately defines who we are in the world, much more than what we're thinking. Because if we were who we were thinking, we would all be pretty ugly people a lot of the time, you know?
Yeah. No, I know. I have some of these thoughts just come out and I'm like, what? Who is that thinking that thought? That's not Marie. No.
I'm a monster.
Yeah. Just some of the morbid thoughts that cross through my head. Yes. We are all very, very human, and it's fascinating. Now it requires though a certain amount of self-awareness, or some might call it mindfulness, to be able to stop, because anger, a lot of these emotions are there as an instinctual reflex to keep us alive.
Yes.
So yes. What is your practice to kind of slow that down so you're not acting on all this crazy stuff?
Well, one thing I do many, many times a day, especially if I'm being provoked in some way by something someone said or done, I'm always asking myself the question, you know, how does love invite me to respond in this moment? You know, what is love asking from me in this moment? And what I notice happen is that if I'm not able to go to love, if I'm still like just enraged and blameful and just want to scream, at the very least, asking that question over and over, it tends to keep me from taking action in the moment. And sometimes that's all we can do. Sometimes the most generous thing we can do is to disengage, to recognize that like all I have to offer this situation is my rage and my disgust. And so I'm not going to offer anything. You know, I'm going to wait. I'm going to take some time for myself. Maybe I'm going to do a little meditation. Maybe I'm going to do a long walk. Maybe I'm going to dance my butt off in my apartment to release some of this energy. But I am not going to respond in this moment because it's not going to serve this situation positively in any way. And what I've learned, and I suspect most people listening can, you know, have learned this in their own way, is that when we take the time to decompress from that moment of impact, when we just want to rage at the person, you know, the rage dissipates, it shifts, and usually we can then approach the conversation through a different lens and one that offers maybe a bit more openness, a bit more empathy to their experience, you know, a bit more flexibility in the way we can see a conversation going. So that's that really that question, it interrupts. And I'm not just talking about the way we interact with others. I'm also talking about the way I interact with myself. You know, my mind, like many others, it's very self-abusive. You know, I'm my greatest critic. I beat up on myself a lot. But when we bring awareness and mindfulness to those moments when we're just attacking ourselves and we can say, wait, you know, how is love inviting me to be present with myself in this moment? And I can assure you, love is never inviting you to call yourself ugly and lazy and worthless and whatever other names we all call ourselves. Love is always inviting us to show up with compassion and with kindness. And yeah, so it's like you said, when we bring the mindfulness, we ask ourselves that question, do a little meditation if that works for you, whatever works for you, and take a little break before you respond.
Thank you, Scott. And I feel like it's important to point out the whole idea of progress, not perfection, which I think has been a thread throughout this whole conversation, is that we do the best we can in each day. And, you know, overall, I feel like a lot of us are doing better and better, but progress isn't linear. It's not just this like one upward straight line.
No.
I wish it was. It'd be nice.
Sometimes it's a downward spiral into the lessons we've been faced with time and again. Yeah, I love that point, Marie, because I think that most of us don't give ourselves credit for how far we've come and how much we've learned. And I think it's imperative to. I think it's imperative to reflect on our successes. Because it's easy, we'll always naturally reflect on what we see as our failures. But can we take the time and some conscious energy to just acknowledge, like, my goodness, I have overcome so much in my life, so many struggles, so many obstacles. Like, I am a warrior. I am resilient. I am strong. No person could be where I am today without strength and without resilience. And to honor that, you know, to honor what it takes to be a living, breathing human being in a reality that, yes, is very beautiful, but is also very dark and disgusting and unpredictable. You know, it's all those things. So I'm with you. Honor the progress.
That is bringing tears to my eyes. I'm just like picturing you and the limited things that I know about the life you've had and what you've overcome. And, you know, we all have overcome so many struggles with, no matter how great our lives look on the surface, there's not anyone who hasn't had struggle.
Absolutely.
And, you know, we got to give ourselves credit for how we're growing past that.
Hallelujah.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're almost out of time, so I should let you get on with your day. But is there anything else, Scott, that you want to add before we say goodbye?
Anything else? One, thank you so much for having me here on your show, and thank you for the work you're doing to share your love and insights and wisdom and creativity with the world. It's important, and we need it. And also, you know, I like to remind people that they're worthy exactly as they are, and that nothing they do could make them any less worthy or any more worthy. And so please recognize that you are worthy. You are worthy right now. And that's all.
No matter how much of a screw up we all can be.
Exactly. And that doesn't mean we can't put our energy into changing and growing and healing all the time. Of course, that's beautiful and necessary, but it doesn't make you any less worthy or more worthy, you know, no matter what's going on.
Thank you so much, Scott. And thank you for being with us for this hour again. The name of the book is Big Love, The Power of Living with a Wide Open Heart, scottstabile.com. And again, Banyan Books, Thursday, October 5th at 6:30 p.m. if you're in Vancouver. I want to send you lots of love. Be well. Namaste.
We don't need to tell you that Vancouver has a housing problem.
Mass evictions.
Mass rent evictions.
Unfair rent increases.
What happened to rent control and protection from unfair eviction?
If these or other housing matters concern you, you may be interested in joining the Vancouver Tenants Union. For more information, visit tenantsunion.ca.
I went to residential school. I was just 8 years old.
Gail Kessler. My name is Gennarji O'Sullivan of the Tlaalit Cis Nation, originally from Turner Island. You're listening to Wendell exploring the legacy of Indian residential schools.
This PSA was cut from a rally called Honor the Apology in Ottawa, Ontario. Those speaking are Clayton Thomas Mueller, Melody McIver, and Jocelyn Ayatoll.
Slow down. You're not in a race. Alcohol-related deaths are one of the leading preventable causes of death in Canada. Please remember to drink responsibly.
Vancouver International Film Festival is back this fall from September 28th to October 13th. Experience some of the best cinema from around the world, features related creator talks and events at one of North America's largest film festivals. With more than 300 films from 73 countries, VIFF's program includes the pick of top international film festivals, as well as many undiscovered gems from around Canada and the world. This year, be sure to catch CITR's sponsored film, Tattoos, a poignant coming-of-age romance between two punk music connoisseurs, screening September 30th and October 1st. For more information and tickets, visit viff.org.
Sequential Circus has been showcasing cutting-edge West Coast live electronic music in Vancouver for over 10 years. Join us for Sequential Circus 21, featuring live musical performances by Bastet, Data Taste, Hitori Tori, Michu Wildleader, and Tegan and Andrew Van Hassel, plus performance art by Claire Jemima, live visuals from Dermot Glennon, and much more. Put on your dancing shoes and join us at 10 p.m. Saturday, October 7th at Open Studios. Visit sequentialcircus.ca or facebook.com/sequentialcircus for more details.
He's a nasty, nasty guy. He's a liar.
Get him out of here. Get him the hell out of here. Get him out of here.
Who is this guy? Does he have a name? Let me know where he's from.
They call me
DJ Ray.
The late night show is the start of the weekend. Tune in every Saturday mornings from 12:30 a.m. to late, right after the Medicine Show. Email us, CITRLateNightShow@gmail.com.
This concludes our proposal. Thank you for your attention.
No. Thank you. You are listening to 101.9 CITR. Get ready for the Parts Unknown Show.
I wish you were fun. I wish you were fun in every way. I wish you were fun to brighten the dark, cold winter day. In every other way, I find you amazing.